This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to All the Right Notes, the BBC Music Magazine podcast. Today we're going to be discussing musical terms, some of the infinitely varied and fascinating terminology that has been used to describe how music should be performed. From andante to vibrato, we're going to look at a few of classical music's more intriguing terms. We'll discuss how they entered the musical lexicon and how successive composers have stuck, or not, to their meanings. Joining me for this fascinating discussion is writer Jessica Duchin, whose books include Immortal, which explores the identity of Beethoven's mysterious immortal beloved, and Ghost Variations, which tells the astonishing story of the Schumann Violin Concerto's bizarre discovery in the 1930s. Jessica, hi.
Hello, Steve. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Oh, it's great to have you. Thank you. So, musical terms, let's begin with a kind of broad brush introduction. Let's talk a little about why we have musical terms. What functions generally are words like adagio or presto performing?
If you think about how much information a composer wants to convey to their performers and how very little you can actually put on a page of what you want to convey, the musical terms are a hugely important part of that. They are, in the end, quite a broad brushstroke, but at least it gives the performer a guide to the atmosphere, the colour, the speed, the general musical approach that is desired. It stops them veering off in 180 degrees in the wrong direction.
Indeed. So without musical terms, what, you know, would music be radically different? Would it be incredibly difficult for performers to interpret in the way the composer originally intended?
I think it varies a lot from style to style. I mean, these things didn't exist so much in the Baroque era, for example. So the vast majority of Bach's keyboard music doesn't have these directives on it. So in these cases, you have to work out for yourself what is desired by looking at the nature of the notes on the page, how they're divided up bar by bar. And there's a very nice trick called harmonic rhythm. So you can kind of work out the tempo by the speed at which the harmonies change. Because if you have one harmony that goes on for 8 bars, or 7 bars, and then a dominant, as you get, for instance, at the beginning of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. You don't want that to go slowly because everyone's going to be asleep before you get to the repeat sign. So that's a guide. And in a way, I can see why composers would leave them off at that point, because firstly, it gives their performers a bit more freedom. And secondly, they expect the performers to have enough intelligence to be able to work it out that way.
Yes.
Now, it was not ever thus. And by the time you reach the middle of the 19th century, it is very definitely not thus.
That's fascinating. Let's look at a few individual terms, because there's some quite interesting stories both behind how these words emerge and how they've been interpreted by different composers and conductors. I thought andante is quite an interesting one to begin with. I think that's been interpreted in slightly different ways at various different times. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Well, andante is often thought of as being the mark of a slow movement. It actually isn't, because andante means at a walking pace, and people walk at very different speeds. I mean, you can have a nice ambly stroll in the forest, or you can be marching to the shops and back, and whatever you do, it's at a walking pace. So if you see the word andante and you think that's a nice, relaxing, slow movement, you may end up taking it a little bit slower than it was originally intended, to put it mildly.
Are there examples in the classical music literature where what's written on the pages andante is actually heard and performed in quite different speeds? Are there slower and faster, gentler and more frenetic andantes?
Oh, definitely. I think Mozart is a case in point, probably Haydn as well. If you think about the interpretations that you started to get through the early music revolution, before all of that happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you could put on a recording of a piece by one of these great Viennese classic composers, and it might go really rather slowly and rather portentously. And then suddenly along would come Hogwood or Norrington or Harnoncourt, and suddenly it's a bit lickety-split.
Mm.
So there are some very big differences in interpretation. And I actually remember when I was a very young and green music journalist, I went to a record launch for Roger Norrington, which was being held by his record company, and I had been to a performance he had done of The Magic Flute, which was very, very lickety-split.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a bit perturbed by this, because I grew up with the Klemperer recording, which was made in about 1962, I think, and is altogether more ponderous, although extremely beautiful. So I gathered my courage and I went up to Roger Norrington and I said to him, I absolutely loved your performance of The Magic Flute, but I'm curious about your tempi. Why do you take the slow bit so fast? And I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to say to a famous conductor if you're a sort of, you know, you're in your first job in music journalism. He was so lovely about it. He sat me down in a corner and he explained the whole thing. And he talked about harmonic rhythm. He talked about conducting one in a bar. He talked about the illusions of tempo. So it's more than just andante being a walking pace. You can be going at the same speed, but it can feel completely different,
okay,
according to the emphasis that's being placed on the rhythm and the sense that you have one beat in a bar, even when it might be written that it's two or something. These things are infinitely malleable.
Mm.
That gives some indication of just how subtle and complicated,
yes,
it becomes. It's like lifting the lid on what looks like a little tin, and then you look down and you can see all the way to the centre of the earth.
Yes, okay, nice analogy. So to this day, do you like to hear a piece of Haydn as conducted by Klemperer, or more in the Norrington vein, or do you think both have their merits?
I think both have their merits. I mean, I like Norrington's Haydn very, very much. There are some period performances that I like a great deal less. And there are some historic performances that I like a great deal more. But there's room for everything.
Yes. Well, that's good to bear in mind as we consider all these terms, isn't it? Another with quite a elastic definition over time. I'm interested in the term scherzo. Can you tell us a bit about what that originally means and how that came to be interpreted?
Well, the term scherzo actually means joke. Now, the number of scherzos in the classical repertoire that can actually end up sounding like a joke, you can probably count on the fingers of one hand. Very often, it's the term that is given to the second or third movement of a symphony, which would, in the initial genesis of the symphony, have been the minuet. Now, the minuet started to go out of fashion, I think, when the waltz was invented, which was around the early 19th century, probably around 1800 or thereabouts. So you're much more likely to find a minuet in Haydn than you are in, you're basically not going to find a minuet in Brahms, to the best of my knowledge. The scherzo, therefore, has that three in a bar tradition that would have come from the minuet, but it goes a lot faster. And I think it was probably popularized by Beethoven. I'm not going to swear to that. I think Haydn probably started it with the Opus 33 yes. string quartets. But Beethoven, being Haydn's pupil, would have taken it up and applied it to very non-jokey things like the third movement of the Fifth Symphony. As you move into the Romantic period, you get the scherzo taken up by incredible people like Mendelssohn, who made it into something that I think Haydn would have fallen off his chair if he had heard the scherzo from A Midsummer Night's Dream, or the scherzo of the octet, which actually is not in 3-4, that the octet. But it's something magical and light and sort of twilight and fly-by-night. This very almost supernatural atmosphere he brings to it. And then Chopin's four scherzi are virtually gothic in their impact. I mean, the scherzo in B-flat minor could be out of a horror movie.
Yes.
I don't know if it's ever been used as a horror movie, but if it hasn't, someone's missed a trick. And then there's a wonderful story about Brahms writing a very self-deprecating letter about his second piano concerto, which is one of the bigger of the Romantic piano concertos, to put it mildly, and saying, see, he's something like, oh, there's a nice little scherzo. This thing is massive. Mm. It's absolutely huge.
Yes, and dramatic and conflicted, isn't it? And,
yeah. Exactly.
Yes, okay. So we move a long way from the original meaning of joke, but it gets interpreted in fascinating ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, so every composer has their own take on, and their own infinite number of takes, indeed,
yes.
on what it can, if you push the boat out, and what it can mean.
Yes, definitely. In particular, as you say with Mendelssohn, if I see scherzo, I'm expecting something fairy-like and magical and at some frenetic wheeling pace often, yeah. Excellent. A third interesting term, rubato. Can you tell us a little bit about the meaning and kind of development of that one?
Well, rubato is yet another can of worms, really. It means literally robbed time. So what it refers to is the flexibility in the flow of your piece of music. This became quite a big deal in the period around Chopin. And in Chopin, there are a number of examples of moments where he writes rubato. What he wants is basically it's a slowing down, but then a catching up with yourself.
Uh-huh.
It's robbed time, but you then have to pay the time back.
Mm.
And this is what some pianists performing Chopin don't always realize that. So they'll slow down and they don't pay it back. They just sort of drag their feet and then they sort of gradually catch up again. I mean, you don't generally want a sort of lurch effect, but it's a give and take.
Yes,
so you can't just take and never give.
Yes, okay. So it's a period of kind of elasticity with the rhythm, but over the overarching piece as a whole, you've got to keep
yeah,
to that.
It tends to be thought of, I think, in just thinking back to the kind of things my piano teacher used to tell me about it, because I'm sure I was very bad at this. Mm. I think that what you are generally expected to have as a baseline will be a regular pace within which you vary the flow according to the expression that you want through rubato, moments of rubato.
Okay.
And the amount that you use depends very much on the composer and the directions. If the composer asks you for rubato, you better do it. Mm. If the composer doesn't ask you for rubato, then you have to apply your own judgment. So with a composer like Fauré, for example, there are lots of accounts of Fauré playing the piano and describing him performing it in very strict tempo, and he doesn't like rubato. He doesn't pull the fabric about. You still get pianists today who do play Fauré with a lot of rubato, okay, and it doesn't always work. There are some who make it work wonderfully. So it depends very much on the individual artistry that's going on in the performer.
Yes.
But generally in that French school, there's, because so much of its influence comes from the Baroque, there's a sort of backbone to it. It's like good posture in a dancer. And actually, if you think of tempo as good posture, if you pull it around with rubato all the time, you lose that good posture. You don't want really to swoon and splurge and collapse everywhere. Otherwise, the music doesn't stand up.
And there are moments I can think of a couple of examples of moments where music is taken at an extremely slow pace, almost as to lose its kind of sense of forward motion. I don't know. I'm thinking of, for example, I remember Bernstein conducting Schumann's Second Symphony, the slow movement he does at a very slow pace, and other things. So there's clearly, you know, there's often a kind of momentum that you need to try to stick to.
Yeah, I'm thinking also of Korngold, because Korngold is another whole universe of interpretation, because he is a control freak.
Right.
He writes out most of the rubato that he wants.
Okay.
So if you look at his scores, you'll see that the time signatures change all the time. And actually what he's doing very often is he is writing the rubato that he wants into the music. Oh. So if you just play what he's written, you will get this wonderful, flexible, beautiful canvas that seems to ebb and flow very naturally. And you add to that, you can add some, I suppose, but you do so at your peril. And I remember doing a building a library on the violin concerto. And my goodness, there are violinists who swoop and swoon and faint, and it sounds absolutely terrible to my ears, because you don't need to do that. It's there already. So again, you need to look at the composer and think about what they are really requiring.
Yes, very interesting. A degree of freedom, but often, you know, don't overdo it. Otherwise, you may lose structural momentum or something. Yeah. That's fascinating.
And also, the more emotional the music is, very often the less you need to add, because it's like taking a chocolate pudding and pouring treacle all over it.
Quite. Over-egging, yes, indeed. Definitely. One other term, or a pair of terms, actually, I mentioned one of them in the intro. I'm interested in vibrato and tremolo, which I think may seem to some to be quite similar in characteristics, you know, denoting some kind of trembling. But in fact, they have subtly or quite different meanings. Can you just walk us through those two?
I'd say they're completely different, actually. It's interesting. If you look at Leopold Mozart's treatise on violin playing, which was published, I think, something like 1750, in the 1750s, he provides exercises for what a violinist would recognize as vibrato. But he doesn't call it vibrato. He calls it tremolato.
Right.
But it's there. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was learning violin as a kiddie, I remember being given those exercises. And actually that treatise is actually a manual for the teachers of beginners, which is something that also gets ignored quite a lot. But that's a topic for another time. Vibrato, if you think, for example's sake, about playing a violin, vibrato is what you do with the left hand on the string. It refers to the tiny movements that you make with your finger or your wrist or your elbow that just make the sound vibrate and give it that lovely fullness of tone. tremolo would be what you do with your right hand on the bow. So if you think, for example, of the beginning of a Bruckner symphony, that very quiet, very rustly,
yes,
atmospheric sound, that is tremolo.
Mm. Okay, yes, quite different things. Fascinating. I just wanted to conclude by thinking about the language in what most of these terms were written, Italian. Obviously, that seemed to dominate for centuries, but we have examples of some composers who didn't always follow the Italian norms. And can you give us any examples of composers who decided to create slightly different musical languages and why?
I guess the one that springs instantly to mind is Beethoven, because he got fed up with using Italian. He felt that his market would actually know much more exactly what he meant if he used German. So at some point he switched to German. And the most famous example of this is his Hammerklavier Sonata. Because if he had stuck with Italian, that would have been the forte piano sonata, which doesn't have the same ring to it somehow. The Hammerklavier was simply the German word for the latest model of that fast-developing musical instrument, the forte piano, or indeed the pianoforte.
Yes, but the word sticks so well to it now, doesn't it? It sounds much more, as you say, gargantuan and emphatic and suits the work much better somehow.
It certainly does. And then in the wake of Beethoven, I guess the one who really jumps into my mind is Schumann, Robert Schumann, whose German instructions often seem to me to be rather more nuanced than would necessarily be possible in Italian. So, you know, something like I've brought in, please excuse the sound of pages turning, but I have here a copy of the Davidsbunder Tänze. So you have directions in here which might or might not translate into Italian. You have one that is lebhaft, which I suppose you could have said vivace or something like that, but it suggests a lightness and a swing, almost in the sound of that word, lebhaft.
Yes, definitely.
You want it to sound that way.
Definitely.
And innig, which is that very wonderful German romantic inwardness. That's the second piece.
Nothing quite like it in Italian again.
Then there's the fourth piece is marked ungeduldig.
Right, what's
which means impatiently.
Splendid.
Now, there may be an Italian equivalent, but if there is, I don't happen to know what it is right now.
No, I think Schumann realised that these words were much more expressive in his native tongue, didn't he?
So he's full of things like that. There's one piece in that same set that's headed Balladen Messig, and then Sehr rasch. So it's a massively, heftily ballad-like piece that he wants to go fast.
Yes, yes.
And if you think of that and you play it that way, boy, do you get Schumann.
Yes, exactly. And couldn't quite be rendered any other way. No, that's brilliant. Jessica, thank you so much. That's been a really fun and fascinating chat about our musical lexicon. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Steve.
So thanks to Jessica Dushan there for that very illuminating walk through some of our key musical terms, how they've been interpreted, not always correctly, down the centuries. I'm in the studio with my BBC Music magazine colleagues, Charlotte Smith, Jeremy Pound and Michael Beek.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello all. I'm going to begin by asking you if you have any favourite musical terms, or indeed any non-favourite musical terms, Michael.
My favourite musical term, Steve, is sforzando, which just looks fabulous because it's sort of a very interesting looking word.
Very important to look fabulous.
Absolutely. Yes. It just looks very dramatic. And it actually sounds, very, very dramatic word to say.
Well, it's an onomatopoeic one, isn't it?
I beg your pardon?
It's an onomatopoeic one. It does what it says in the word.
So, oh, yes, absolutely.
Sforzando.
Absolutely.
Yes, very good.
It's sudden, strong, it's dramatic.
It's impactful. I love it. Oof. Good choice. Jeremy?
I've got ones I dislike.
Oh, let's hear those.
I still have bad memories of trying to remember which order. You know, when you look at a metronome, you've got all the various speeds on a metronome. I still can't remember which order they come in. So is andante quicker or slower than adagio? What about allegro and allegretto? Which one, which order they come? And I dread it in a pub quiz, because quite often you get the question, what does allegro mean? And I always think, oh, can I actually remember what it actually means? I think they're looking for the answer fast, but I wouldn't necessarily say that allegro is fast. I'd say presto is fast. And there's that kind of whole, there's kind of that splat of, they all seem to begin with A as well, of terms in the middle of the metronome, and I can never remember which order they should be in.
I think allegro is fast and presto is very fast.
Surely.
There are a few words for fast, really, aren't there?
I mean, you've got moderato, slap bang in the middle, that's which is good. I suppose that's your guiding point, but
I had no idea that scherzo meant joke.
Yes. There we go.
Exactly.
Yeah, there we go. Humour and music. I've got a couple of other favourites. Like you, I've gone for the Italian, which I suppose most of them are, but I like a bit of onomatopoeia, and I like a word that's fun to say, so I'm very fond of bisbigliando, which means very light and murmuring.
Wow. Used as a direction. That's a good one.
Often in music, for a finger tremolo on the harp. You can imagine it, can't you?
Oh, yes.
Bisbigliando. Apologies for the Italian. One more. One more was lusinghiero, which means coaxingly, flatteringly, caressingly, which you'll hear cropping up in Beethoven's 14th string quartet. Some nice words out there, which I hope are obeyed in the score. Charlotte, you wanted to tell us about two particular terms. And
I mean, I was interested in what Jessica had to say about tremolo versus vibrato, because they are quite separate concepts if you're a string player. But I can see why they might have got confused, especially with that Leopold Mozart treatise where he's talking about violin playing and he calls vibrato tremolato. That's a very strange one. I mean, that's an interesting manual, because it's always used as kind of a stick to hit violin players and string players who use too much vibrato throughout the whole performance, because Leopold Mozart wanted it just to be used as an ornament rather than throughout everything as a source. And so people always use that as like, so you shouldn't be doing that in period music. But in any case, they are quite different. So tremolo on a violin, it means trembling or quivering in Italian, but it's basically the rapid repetition of a single note, or it can be two different notes, but they have to be separated then more than a semitone or a tone. Because if it's a semitone or a tone, that's a trill. So if you have, on a bowstring instrument, you repeat that single note and you rapidly move the bow back and forth. And I've actually recorded myself on my own violin doing a little example. So here you go.
Ooh, let's hear that.
So there you go. That's
lovely. Fantastic.
So there you go. That's tremolo. Yeah, that's whereas vibrato means to vibrate in Italian, and that's actually about pitch variation. So we're not talking about repeating the same note, but varying the pitch. And so this is a deliberate, regular, periodic change in pitch. It's like a controlled warble, but it's generally much less than a semitone. So although you're pivoting on the note, you're not going so far wide, unless, you're not a great player. If you're going, all the way down a semitone, you wouldn't be doing that. But yeah, so basically on a violin, you use your left hand, which is the hand that you use to make the notes, and the finger goes on the string, and then you use either your wrist or your arm or a combination of both, and you basically rock on the note on that finger, and that makes vibrato. And again, I've recorded a little example of myself doing that here. So there you go.
That's brilliant. What better way to illustrate two terms? Thanks for that, Charlotte. Fantastic. What about these terms? How important are they in the interpretation of music? How important is it to follow a score to the letter, including the instructions left there by the composer, or are performers allowed a certain amount of artistic license in the way they interpret a score, do you think?
I think they should be allowed to interpret even the word as they see fit, because as Jessica said, there's some quite, disparity between how these things are interpreted by conductors and musicians. And also, with so much of this music, we can never really know what they really intended. We can't go and ask them. Mm-hmm. Living composers, yes, we can actually consult them, but why not?
There's always the case that composers might themselves have changed their mind hearing their music performed a different way. They might have originally written a term down, then heard it differently, thought, well, actually, That works
true.
As well.
That's true.
Particularly with a modern symphony orchestra versus perhaps the orchestra that they had in their time.
Yes.
If they heard it played by a modern symphony orchestra, maybe they'd think of it, they'd want it in a completely different character,
that's
a completely
true.
Different speed.
It so, could mean a revelation, yeah. Yeah, indeed. No, some fascinating insights. Thanks very much all, and thanks to Jessica again for this illuminating walk through musical terms on All the Right Notes podcast. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.